We are really happy to have you here and hear your talk about PubHubs, which is one of the federal various projects you have in your portfolio of public spaces. And yeah, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I feel a bit intimidated because I feel like I'm the dumbest person here in the room. I mean, you seem like very hardcore coders, developers, open source, evangelists and so on. And I'm just a guy, a manager working in a public broadcasting company that felt a couple of years ago, we need to change the world, as Alexander said. Okay, so how do you go about it? I'm a journalist by profession. I've worked for a long time in print media, and then I was a freelancer for a couple of years, and then I moved on to broadcasting. When I look back upon, you know, my working life, I imagine that all my life I've been motivated, especially by, I've been an idealist in a way all my life, and it's only fairly recently that I've been able to kind of convert that concept of idealism into a number of distinct values. What does this idealism actually mean? And these values coincide with the public values that we've put down as a basic manifesto in the public spaces founding document, which is a manifesto that states at the outset that we need to make the internet a better place, a safer place, a place where public values are actually held in high regard, not only that, but are protected and promoted. So that means that we expect the internet to be a safe place, to be transparent, to be sovereign, to be independent from any type of, you know, hidden agenda or commercial influence. Obviously, we realize that's impossible to do because the internet is a commercial place. But at the very least, as a public organization, which we are in public service media, we need to think about establishing a space where public services, plural, not just public service media, but also organizations in healthcare, organizations in education and so on, can actually work and find all the functionality that they need in order to do their business, whether it's reach out to their audiences, whether it's interaction, engaging with their audiences, whether it's you know, sending out newsletters and do all the other stuff that you would expect a public service organization to do. So Public Spaces is basically a coalition started 4 years ago in the Netherlands. It's got about 45 members at the moment, 45 large public, large and small public organizations, ranging from the Royal Dutch Library, Wikipedia Netherlands, and a number of public broadcasters, to health organizations, the large ICT umbrella organizations for the entire educational system in the Netherlands. We're currently engaging in discussions with the city of Amsterdam to be the first municipality to join Public Spaces. And we finished our conference last week, our annual conference. And for the very, very first time, we've got a minister of digitalization in the Netherlands. And she honored us with her presence, which is kind of a big deal because that we feel it's like an official recognition for the kind of work that we're trying to do and for, you know, that we get some kind of, possibly some kind of inroads in the political system in the Netherlands, but also in the bureaucratic system. What we need in order to actually get some traction and get some things done. Public space is based on public values. We've got two operational lines. I'm going to stick in my talk about PubHubs, which is the second operational line. The first operational line I will touch upon briefly. I think I saw it in Volker's written piece, but I was too late to hear him talk about it. We also got an operational line that we call the digital power wash. Did you elaborate a little bit on that? Or?
Okay. Very briefly.
Okay, just a single word on that then. The digital power wash is actually an instrument for organizations to inventory the kind of instruments and tools that they are using in order to conduct their business, whether it's, you know, the analytical tools that they're using to analyze audiences' engagement, whether it's their content management system, any type of functionality, digital functionality, digital equipment that you use that has a public-facing component, that subject can be made subject to the digital power wash. And the digital power wash is basically just a spreadsheet of questions, about 30 of them. Each of those questions relate to one of the five core public values of public spaces. So it's a translation, if you will, of public values like sovereignty, autonomy, and so on, to something you can actually measure. So to what extent does, for instance, Google Analytics, if you were to choose that particular software package, to what extent does that comply with the public spaces values? And if it doesn't comply so good, so well, I mean, you can score between 0 and 100%. We did this exercise for my organization, VPRO. With our setup and configuration, it scored about 60%. That's because we actually hide the last two tuples from of IP addresses from Google. But still, it's not the highest possible scoring mechanism. There are other alternatives that can do better. We've scored those. So it helps us actually make a transition from Google Analytics to, in this case, Matomo, which we're going to use instead. So you can imagine that if you kind of like take your entire digital inventory through the power wash, little by little, you are able to like clean up your act and to make to clean up your own little street, your own little corner of the internet. What's important also is that what we're trying to do is aggregate all those scores. So in the end, it will lead to a knowledge base where all those tools can be compared to each other. That allows us some benchmarking. What are actually the best within any given, you know, sphere or category of functionality, and how is my organization doing compared to the other? Also, it will help us identify, and Volker touched upon that as well, help us identify where current software providers are lacking. Those can be both open source and commercial software providers. If you know, there's this awareness that actually there is not really a very good moderation system in place that's helping us to moderate user comments based on public values, that would be like a challenge for the participating organizations, but also for open source, but also for commercial platforms, to kind of, you know, jump in that hole and to see whether it's possible to fill that gap and to provide us with a package that actually scores well. I think that about sums up the basics of you know, the one operational line, the power wash. I should also mention, finally, because to give you an idea of the kind of possible impact that we have at public spaces, we reach 17 million people, about the entire Dutch population. And that, you know, allows us to scale up and to test and to experiment easily. And also can help us provide us with some of the networking effects that we're going to need in order to get alternative social platforms really moving. And that's what I'm going to focus on today, PubHubs. First, some general points on the horizon. We feel that at VPRO, for instance, we do a documentary series. It's called Backlight in English. And Backlight is, we call it a future affairs documentary. It kind of develops alternative narratives, storytelling for some of the problems that we're currently facing in all kinds of areas, from the environment to climate to the economy. You know, we've got people like Kate Raworth with her donut ideas. We're talking about education, we talk about city planning. That's the documentary shows. We also talk a lot about surveillance capitalism and about our digital environment. Still, on the other hand, we use YouTube and Facebook in order to get that particular show out to our audiences, and that's hypocritical, right? I mean, that's how can we criticize the practices of Facebook and Instagram and so on, while at the same time using it in order to get our message across? And that's kind of like being a teacher, trying to make the kids in your classroom digitally literate while giving them Chromebooks. It's kind of like asking Mark Zuckerberg to distribute your media. It's like you're a doctor and you're storing your patient files on the cloud based in the United States. Those are all the kinds of things that PubHubs Public Spaces is trying to address, but also PubHubs is going to try to address, especially in the sphere of digital social platforms. So it's this digital environment with public values embedded in it. Safe social interaction is really important. You need to be able to interact with your friends, with your colleagues, but also make sure that people can always have a safe place where they can be part of a community. That's a core value. And one of the basic tenets is that we define collectivity is more important than connectivity, right? I mean, Facebook is trying to build this community of 3.5 billion people. Well, there is no such thing as a community of 3.5 billion people. That doesn't exist. People tend to congregate in much smaller communities where these, collections of people with like-minded interests or common themes are defining how they behave toward one another. So we prioritize collectivity, the collection of a limited number of people over trying to reach the entire world, over connectivity. So you've been through this. Some of you have heard this presentation before, by the way. I apologize because I understand that it has been on the agenda last Tuesday. But for a lot of you, it's still new. So I'm still trying to get everybody on the same page. So this is a real life example. You need to register your kids for a school trip through Facebook. And that's not what you want to do. And the school says, well, okay, that's all we can do because what other platform is there? And that's where PubHubs comes into play. We try to kind of evolve or develop this alternative. And if we make a comparison between Facebook and PubHubs, these are defining characteristics of Facebook, right? Every user is by default exposed to the entire world. If I make an account at Facebook, it's open to anybody and everybody. But I can make a fake account, and I can make as many fake accounts as I want. I mean, they've tightened up a little bit their onboarding process, but it's still possible and easily possible for me to make many fake accounts, and people are still doing that. Facebook doesn't really take care because, I mean, all they care about is maximizing shareholder value, right? There are obviously some developments right now where Facebook is forced to take care, to take a bit more care at least. I mean, there's the Digital Markets Act, Digital Services Act. There's some development in the United States. But still, that's from a very much a political and legal point of view. And they do as little as possible. A core tenet is that in order to maximize the shareholder value, Facebook does anything, really. I mean, Francis Huang has shown that, and there have been many others who've shown that. Users are manipulated commercially, politically, emotionally. People are being made addicted, etc. Facebook doesn't care about the veracity and the authenticity of information. And the kind of optimization algorithms that they employ lead to extremism. We don't need to really go in detail about it. It's been heavily documented in many places. We're seeing PubHubs as a collection of hubs run by partner organizations. So that's the first big difference, right? I mean, instead of building this one big block, we're saying, okay, if I'm at VPRO, if I'm at CBA, or if I'm at any other type of recognizable organization, I am allowed to build this pub. And this pub is going to be at the core of a network of other hubs. Users interact not with the entire network, but with this specific hub, and they can easily switch between hubs. Very important is a third one. Hubs have a duty of care. We can also call that a kind of fiduciary obligation. like a bank has to take care that there's no money laundering taking place within that particular environment. So a hub owner or a hub operator has to take care of certain specific and minimal requirements about user verification, about content authentication. Users can have different pseudonyms in different hubs. I'm going to be talking in more detail about that a little bit later. Hubs are developed or can be subdivided into rooms for specific interests where different authentication requirements can be put into place. And PubHubs is open source and not for profit. So at a very high level, you can imagine there's going to be a CBA hub, there's going to be a Royal Dutch Library hub, there's going to be a ZDF hub, and there's going to be a lot of different hubs. They are all responsible for their own deployment and their own user moderation and their own governance. And there's really no central infrastructure but a central login. Which is going to be based at this moment of development on IRMA, which is the authentication system developed also in the Netherlands that allows me to separate authentication from identification, right? I mean, if I need to be authenticated as a Dutchman, I can do so without devolving or without publishing my identity, that my name is Geert-Jan Boogaerts, by making some connection with, for instance, our municipal administration that can verify that I'm indeed Dutch. I can verify that I'm of a certain age. I can verify that I'm male. I can verify that I'm a member of my local chess club, and so on and so forth. So this separation of identity from authenticity is really core at the entire account system of PubHubs. Once users are logged in, they can freely move between hubs, but they will have their own pseudonym in every different hub. And that pseudonym can be part of a freely chosen name, but obviously hubs can require people to log in with their real name, because that's one of the personal attributes that, you know, can be asked, and that basically on a hub level to be determined, can be asked to disclose, right? So let's say I'm doing this, running this forum on PubHubs that involves being required to be a certified doctor, right? I can put that requirement in place for that particular hub, so that only doctors will be able to take part in that particular discussion, and that's really important. But also, in order to avoid the appearance of echo chambers, users need to be able not only move between hubs, but to also have, you can also as a hub run a shared room with other hubs. So there's a VPRO hub that has rooms for members of our broadcasting organization, which needs some kind of member authentication, so a verification that this person who is logging in is actually a member. It can be a room for a particular TV program that doesn't require any authentication at all, and a general discussion forum where you will want to have perhaps a real name policy. But that's really up to VPRO, what they want to do and the kind of authentication policy that they want to put in place. You can have a school of a university hub that allows for students to come together in particular hubs or classes, for teachers and researchers to be having discussions in different classes, parents per class and so on. A library hub, one of the use cases that we've identified is we've got this local library system, public library system in the Netherlands. A lot of those public libraries are now running conversations about city planning in their particular municipality. Perhaps you want, as a public library in the city where you live, you want to verify that those users are actually inhabitants of that particular city and not, you know, meddling in from elsewhere. So those are all possibilities. Neighborhood hubs or municipality hubs that allow for neighborhood rooms, local citizen discussions, but also for democratic forums, if you want to, like having election talks or being able to verify or to conduct certain municipality business online. It's based on Matrix. I'm not sure if everybody's familiar with Matrix. It's an open source like Slack. I think you can compare best to Slack alternative. Out of the box, it offers a chat, voice, video. It's end-to-end encrypted and locally stored. And it's already being used by the German and French government. Matrix is with that particular implementations and claims to have about 40 million users. So that's a kind of a proven base upon which to build our open source platform pop-ups. There's going to be, I already discussed that a little bit, this contextual identity management through IRMA and PEP. PEP is a pseudonymization procedure. And IRMA is actually stored on your mobile phone. So all your personal data are stored on your mobile phone. They're not centrally located. The only thing that's centrally located is an email address and a mobile number. One of the things that we still need to discuss is to what extent or who governs that particular central node where all these central logins are stored. I'm going to touch upon that a little bit later. Governance issues are some of the most important ones that still need to address, and I'm going to categorize them a little bit later. In each new hub, a user gets a new stable pseudonym, and a room may impose its own authentication requirements. And users that misbehave may be blocked from rooms or hubs. Those are still the rather easy cases. I mean, each hub and each room can have its own user moderation policy. So what's allowed in one room cannot be allowed in another room. But if users consistently misbehave over different rooms and different hubs, what kind of, you know, blocking policy would you put in place on a central level? And we've got some interesting solutions about that as well, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later. So hubs are run by partner organizations. Technically, each runs their own Matrix home server, and they organize rooms within their own hub, and they can have as many rooms as they want. And what's also very important is the design, especially the look and feel, because on the one hand, at VPRO, we want to put in place our particular VPRO branding, right? I mean, we've got this business requirement that we want to be easily recognizable as a VPRO hub. And the same goes for any other hub. They have their own marketing, they have their own look and feel and so on. On the other hand, you also want it to be recognizable as a pub hub instance, so that people, users, are aware, made aware of the fact that they are actually in this safe environment. And it's just not any social platform, it's actually a pub-ups platform. Such a partner organization has this particular duty of care. It can develop its own pub-hub or its own hub rules. It can put in place its own moderation policy, its own user access policy, and it involves, at the very least, moderation and dispute resolution. So, unlike at Facebook or at Twitter or many of the other existing social platforms, it becomes immediately clear who is responsible for the kind of moderation policy that you're putting in place. There's not some kind of anonymous body that you need to contact and then, you know, your email or your chat kind of disappears in some kind of dark cloud. No, there's going to be a telephone number, there's going to be a recognizable brand, if you will, that you can address and that you can even take to court if needs be, ultimately. So it's a much lower barrier to actually engaging in this dispute resolution conversation with a hub than we know from existing social platforms. So what's to stop any kind of organization to put up their own Matrix server and to claim that they're actually part of PubHubs. I mean, it's open source, so anybody can do that, right? Well, I think there the analogy with Mastodon comes into place. We require each partner organization to sign a contract with the PubHubs central organization. And again, I'm going to talk about this central organization a little bit later on. Once they've signed that contract, and only when they sign the contract, they get access to the PubHub's identity system, and that regulates rules and duties. Again, just like Mastodon centrally is saying, well, if you want to be part of, or if you want to have access to the Mastodon central server, you need to abide by certain rules and regulations, and if not, we can deny your access. And we ask partners also to pay a moderate fee for financial continuity. So that's important for this, you know, a kind of initiative to be sustainable in the longer run, that we do not want to be dependent upon public financing, solely on public financing. We think that's a dangerous path to go by. We do not want to be fully commercial. What we are trying to do is step into this, you know, ancient idea of the commons. And the commons is being defined as, you know, whatever is good for the general public, the general well-being. I realize that sounds very vague, but it's like the air that we breathe, right? It's a common good. So we feel this part of the internet has to be arranged like a common good. Then about rooms. All interactions doesn't happen at a hub level, it happens at a room level. So a hub has to have at least one particular room for any type of interaction to take place. And again, possibly after proportional attribute-based authentication. So that's not a precondition for interacting. You do need to have an account, but you can take place in any conversation if the hub says so, or the room says so, completely, you know, without any further authentication. But that's not, you know, not a given beforehand. And this is the kind of basic functionality that we require, or that we envision to be available within each and every room. So this is not all going to be developed from this central development platform. I mean, because of the fact that we are building this on Matrix, partner organizations can, you know, if they feel, okay, we urgently need some kind of polling functionality within a particular room, they can pick up the source code and develop that themselves. And the central organization can or may then decide to merge it back into the master or not. And again, depending upon a number of conditions that I can come back to a little bit later. But these are some of them. Things that can be envisioned within a room. Current status. There's currently a team working of about 7 people, designers and developers alike, under the leadership of Professor Bart Jacobs. By the way, initial funding for this entire thing is 5 million euros, which was the result of a scientific prize that Bart Jacobs and José van Dijk, the both are leading scientists in this endeavor, received last fall. So there is some basic funding in place, and we are now setting up this program for a period of 5 years. The current focus is on building login and hub navigation, and we expect the first demos to be available this spring, at least. Last week at the Public Spaces conference, we actually showed a little login demo. But we expect the first real pilot, you know, in actual rooms with actual hubs, to be running this fall sometime. José van Dijk, the other professor, is the other leading scientist in this endeavor, and she is a social scientist. Bart Jacobs is, he's specialized in cybersecurity. I think he's one of the world's leading scientists in terms of cryptographic cryptography and digitally signing content and certificates. Jose van Dijk is a social scientist, so she focuses very much on the thought leadership, on the kind of governance issues that are still very much open for discussion. And what we're using public spaces for is actually two things. In this phase, we're still gathering requirements from the public sector, from all those organizations that need to tell this development team, okay, what's the kind of functionality that needs to be prioritized, that we need to develop first, and what can be postponed a little bit later. In another phase, once we've got the first pilots running, Public Spaces is going to provide pop-ups with the testing grounds. I mean, we've got this huge audience reach, we've got a lot of content, so we've got a lot of stuff to work with, and we can do A/B testing, all the other things that need to be done in order to kind of, you know, see where we're going and have a kind of research and design process that's cyclical and that allows us to move forward and forward. And the last line of this slide is actually the three main organizations. And the NPO is the Dutch umbrella organization of public broadcasters. Then we got SURF, which is the ICT umbrella organization for the entire education. And we've got the two major patient organizations in the Netherlands. One particularly important use case, probably we're going to put it forward first, is one that was put forward by one of those patient organizations. That one focuses on mental health. And one of the main, you know, one of the most urgent requirements that they have identified is the use case of young women suffering from some kind of eating disorder. So they currently have to use, you know, the open platforms like Facebook or Instagram or whatever to kind of discuss their predicaments and their problems. So that's obviously fraught with dangerous risks, and there's a large obstacle to taking part of in that kind of organizations. So one of the very first use cases that we're going to work on is actually providing a pop-ups room for that particular patient group that will be, attendants will be required to be authenticated based both on gender and on age. And there's going to be a link to another room where you need to be a registered healthcare provider. And those rooms are going to be interconnected. So those women will have a safe place to, you know, discuss amongst themselves their problems. And there is going to be a linkage to these registered healthcare providers. Jose is now currently focusing her research on five different areas. She's building this team. Well, I'm not saying that correctly. She's actually focusing on just the first one, but there's going to be a lot of different categories of research that needs to be done. So these two are under the purview of Jose's research and her group, but there are three other categories of research that still need to be done. On UX UI, accessibility, ethical design of such a platform. How do you do that? How do you avoid, you know, the pitfalls of being user-friendly on the one hand, but being so user-friendly that there's no friction at all? And one of the things that that leading designers have identified is there need to be some kind of friction in order to make people aware of what they are doing digitally. I mean, I can build a login system that's really easy and really accessible and allows you to log in with one click, but that's not safe, that's not secure. So the friction here is, for instance, two-factor authentication, which is an extra layer of protection. And also in the kind of interaction that people are having with such a social platform, how do you prevent them from mindlessly scrolling through a timeline? Talking about timelines, how do you organize timelines? Based on what kind of algorithm? Chronologically, or what kind of, you know, interaction or what kind of influence will an end user have on that particular prioritization system? And obviously the network effects. Just about that, the network effects, we've identified three basic preconditions for any network effect to take place. The first one, you need to have access to exclusive and high-value content. The second one is you need to have access to a long tail of content. And the third one is you need to have access to an audience. We've already established that public spaces has got the access to the audience. We've got this potential reach of 100% of the Dutch population. Since we do organize all those public broadcasters and all public libraries and archive institutions and major museums and education systems, we've got also the exclusive content, and there's also this long tail. So what it really requires is, apart from solving a number of technical issues and problems, obviously, is a focused exertion from these working in that public sphere to actually start using this platform. And that's really up to us, because, I mean, we are those organizations. So it's up to us to start this experiment and to move away little by little, not radically, because that's going to scare away a lot of people at the same time. We can't afford that. But little by little, moving little bits of our audience to this new platform. We've actually got some examples proving that, or at least supporting that assertion. When Beyoncé launched her album Paradise, she did so on Tidal. And within 1 week, it became the number one most downloaded music platform, the app stores, right? I mean, exclusive content and access to audience. When the BBC needed to decide upon some kind of voting system for one of their talent shows, somewhere around 2008 or 9, they used Twitter, and that actually launched Twitter in Britain. That made Twitter big. And the third one is very small scale. One of my colleagues got a baby about a year ago, and she'd been trying to get her friends and family to move from WhatsApp to Signal unsuccessfully. And then she said, I'm only going to put my baby pictures on Signal. So if you want to see those pictures, you're going to have to be on Signal. And that's how she got her family and friends to move to Signal, right? I mean, exclusive content and access to an audience. So, I think we've already seen this one. This one as well. The unresolved questions. Like, if I'm talking about a patient organization, we've got like 600 patient organizations in the Netherlands. I mean, you can't imagine that a disease or any kind of illness, and it does have its own patient organization. Some of them have like 100 or 200 members, but also patient organizations that have hundreds of thousands of members. Will each patient organization have to run its own hub? Or do you, you know, allow umbrella organizations to develop a hub and then to make rooms according to, you know, the kind of requirements that any patient organization has? We don't know yet. That still needs to be determined. Also, organizing co-creation. How do you decide what kind of features to develop first? Who determines that? What kind of democratic, I mean, you mentioned Volker Jan Hendrik's statement, which is very true, how to democratize software development. That's particularly important here. Currently, software development is in the hands of a small development team, and they are still setting up basic requirements. But pretty soon, we're going to need some kind of system that determines what kind of prioritization should take place. And I've also talked a little bit already about the ethical design principles. There's also some... Oops, that was too fast. There's also some very fundamental questions. And I think it's particularly the last one that we've got some ideas about that I find interesting to share with you and perhaps discuss this afternoon. When you talk about normativity, what kind of norms? I mean, I've already said that it's up to each hub to kind of develop its own moderation policy and user content policy and so on. But what if a user consistently misbehaves? I mean, at VPRO, we can say, okay, you're no longer welcome at any VPRO room, so we're going to ban you from the use of the VPRO room. And since there's going to be, you know, it's not going to be possible to set up fake accounts through this centralized login system, that means that we can actually do so. We can actually ban that person forever from VPRO. That's one thing. But what if that person then goes on to move to another hub and misbehaves there? And to another one and misbehaves there? What kind of system should we put in place? And one thing that we're thinking about that's very appealing to me personally is to kind of get it out of the digital realm and go into the physical realm. So we are setting up a system or designing a system now where we would invite such a misbehaved person to have an actual conversation, person to person, to go sit in a room and to explain him or herself. That's based, that idea, on, you know, the observation that we've got, like in most European countries, a lot of problems with trolling people spreading disinformation and so on. And once they get in front of a judge, because part of what they do is actually punishable by law, once they get in front of a judge, they very often say, I had no idea that the impact of what I was doing is so big. I had no idea that it was so perceived as so dangerous or threatening by the receiving person. I simply had no idea. I wasn't thinking. I was just fooling around. So that kind of confrontation could actually be a very important step, that link between the digital and the physical. If in the end that doesn't work and that person still misbehaves, we will still not ban that person from the entire network, because again, we feel that we are providing a basic public functionality. And if you ban that person from that basic public functionality, you're basically taking away a fundamental human right. So the only way in which we could do that would be through a court order. So that's one of the discussions that we're having right now with the parliament, but also with the Home Office in the Netherlands, whether or not it's possible to kind of set up a system where the ultimate decision for such a decision, the ultimate power for such a decision would lie where they belong, with the courts that are, you know, long-standing institutions within our democratic societies. I think that's about sums up what I've had to say. I've been speaking for a long time. I apologize for that. But I hope we can have some kind of interactivity going on in the afternoon.
Yeah, thanks Gert-Jan a lot for this really inspiring. I mean, I had this presentation not a third time, but every time it shifts a lot of things, and every time enough new for me. So your question to the audience, if we shift the whole debate really also for this talk to the afternoon and do a break now, or are there any urgent questions to discuss yet?
There was a question in the chat, in the online chat. If you maybe they said maybe the question is too technical, but maybe you can comment on it anyways. Why you chose Matrix as the primary technology for PubHubs or for the development of PubHubs and not, for example, ActivityPub?
I'm afraid that question is too technical for me. but I will pass it through to Bart Jacobs at least. Yeah, he's the technical lead. There's another question there. I'm sorry to the audience for not being able to answer that.
I see that the system requires a mobile phone, and because it uses Irma, requires a smartphone. And a smartphone by default, it gives you all the notifications and takes you out your concentration of what you are doing. So that have ethical concerns. So I'm worried that I'm happy that you don't want to ban anybody from the entire network because it's a basic public functionality. But I'm worried about people that we are concerned of having a smartphone or using mobile phone network. It looks like we couldn't use this platform. Matrix, for example, solved the problem of end-to-end encryption with not using the mobile phone network or the mobile phone stuff, but you are encouraging in this project using it, and I don't agree with that, and I would like to know what you think about
it. Yeah, I can sympathize with the question. I've got the same ideas, actually, and we're using IRMA at this moment because it's already in place, it's proven technology, it's gaining in traction, and it's a very, you know, it requires all the basic functionalities, or it fulfills all the basic functionalities that we require in this phase. But I think it has to be on our roadmap to provide other kind of, you know, identification or authentication systems as well. That are not necessarily based on using a smartphone. Ultimately, it's a digital platform, right? So you need some kind of digital tool or equipment to be able to log in. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, yeah. It kind of reminds me of another question that I had the other day about people. Okay, but what if I don't have a computer or don't have a phone? Can I still participate? Well, I'm sorry, no, probably not. Because if you don't have a computer, if you don't have any digital equipment at all, how are you going to participate in a digital conversation? Yeah?
Can I answer very briefly? The problem in the development world is that they cannot provide a laptop for everybody. And the a proposal for that solution is to provide centers with computers that are shared between different people.
Sure, sure.
That's something
but
also
still
to
you
be
need
explored.
A digital, you need some kind of digital equipment to participate in the platform. Yeah.
But they're not personal equipment. It's shared and...
Yeah.
That's also something to take in account, especially if we want all to be on that digital space.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's, I think, a question that's a bit out of scope for this particular initiative. That's much more of a political question, I believe, for setting up such centers and so on. But I agree with you, yeah.
So I don't want to go into the discussion now. We'll do that later. But just a question of understanding. So once the pop-up infrastructure is there, when I go to fepero.nl, because I'm interested in the beautiful documentaries that you're doing, where will I land? Will I land directly in the pop-up of fepero, or is there going to be the current landing page and that's more broadcasting, content-oriented? And then there will be points on that site for interaction, for commenting, da, 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 and that will lead me into the pop-up.
Yeah.
Just for understanding.
Yeah, that's going to be the idea. I mean, obviously, it's going to be possible for any organization to make their hub the landing page, also for their own URL. But at VPRO, we don't envision doing that.
I think an ideal system allows to offer even to dial in by telephone as we do with video conferencing. And so this is probably an answer also for you. It must not be necessarily a computer probably to join. We run a big Jitsi cluster with dial in, and if you connect Jitsi to Matrix, you have a dial in option to talk with people even if they don't have a computer.
Mm. Yeah.
My question is, I was walking here and listening to the stream in the bus, probably they didn't get all of your presentation. So what is central and what is really decentralized with pop-up would be a question of understanding to me. So I understand it's the agreement which I have to sign to be part of this network and probably part of the single sign-on elements. Is there anything else? And I have to pay and be a member, a formal member probably, and an NGO which you are going to establish. Is there anything else which is going to be central and doesn't make the centrality make you again a target for whatever, whomever, politicians, hackers, distributed denial of service attacks, etc.
To answer your question about what is central, I think that you kind of summed it up nicely. So it's going to be the central authentication system. It's going to be the contract issuing authority, and it's going to be, you know, the organization that needs to be in place, the NGO that needs to be in place to deal with legal issues and so on. So it kind of reminds me of some of the questions that Volker raised in his previous, where you also need to think about what kind of bodies do you really need to set up in order to organize all this. And there's a degree of vulnerability there that you can, I think, partly address by decentralizing and democratizing as much as possible, while at the same time guaranteeing your basic values. And we can take a leaf from the Mastodon booklet also in this as well. It's not a complete democracy, Mastodon is, because it's got these basic requirements. It's not the majority that kind of decides, right? It's the majority decides, but within a certain given framework. And the framework is almost immovable. And I think that's important here as well. So we need to set up a legal identity, a foundation, or a legal entity, a foundation of some sort, that has these statutes that are immovable, that are cut in granite, if you will. But that would still allow for a role in the decision-making process for, on the one hand, member organizations, but also for the audience at large, and for really any stakeholder that perhaps we still haven't identified, but will be identifying in the near future. Because, I mean, if it's going to be as broad as we envision it going to be, the entire society is in a way a stakeholder. So those are some of the questions that Jose is still trying to get her head around. Sometimes I have an idea that we mentioned that before at the Public Spaces Conference. We're doing some kind of paradigm shift here, and we're trying to really invent something new. I mean, we're obviously building on Matrix, so the software is not so revolutionary. But the entire governance system, the entire research process into what should we prioritize and about these user moderation issues and so on, those are all fairly new questions.
Okay, so then we're gonna shift the rest of the discussion to the next program point, which will actually start at 1 p.m. And thanks for being here and your talk for the time being, and see you later.